You're listening to Trot the Egging, hosted by John Hetherington, working with Widnes Rugby Union Football Club, sponsored by Boydells. This week's rugby story is that of a St Helens lad who grew up playing both football and rugby league. Blackburn Royals was his club, but only after he had to make a decision between the two sports. He made rep teams in both sports. A Man City junior turned professional with Widnes Rugby League, but only once he toured with England to Australia. He went on to play in Australia before returning to Widnes, a better player and person. A move to Salford come about and he had spells with Keighley Cougars, Castleford Tigers, Wakefield Trinity Wildcats and Whitehaven. He also managed to represent England and Wales. He played rugby union for Leicester Tigers, Newport Gwent Dragons, Manchester RUFC, US Dacks and Dallas Old Palmerston, while he also coached the junior side at Widnes Rugby Union. He's a massive supporter of Head for Change. Ladies and gents, Mr. Jason Critchley.
Follow, like, share, subscribe and endorse us via Facebook, Trot the Egging, Twitter, @TrotTheEgging/@JohnHeth, Instagram, @Trot_D_Egg_In, YouTube, Trot the Egging, LinkedIn, John Hetherington, and Spotify, Trot the Egging.
So, Jason, how have you been?
All good. It's been a long time, not like to speak, but I do, like I said, loving the Widnes Rugby Union top that you've got on to it. Take me back my memories when I used to coach many, many moons ago on my my oldest boys team.
Oh, it is. We're just talking off mic, mate, weren't we, about how we know common people and stuff like that. It's a small world, the rugby world, mate, isn't it? And
it is, yeah, very much so, even sort of whether it be locally or internationally, to be fair, I'm quite lucky in that respect that sort of you don't see somebody for, I don't know, maybe 10, 20 years and all of a sudden you bump into somebody and then it's as if you would never, you go back 20 years and it's like you've never been away to for the period that you've not seen each other doesn't exist. Or the rugby family is pretty special. I suppose the four of us are lucky enough that we're part of that.
Oh, definitely, mate. So before we get stuck into your rugby story, mate, where was home for you as a kid and who lived at home with you?
So I'm a St Helens boy, born and bred in St Helens with very much strong Welsh ancestry. Mum, dad and baby sister were at home. Grew up as obviously I went to St Cuthbert's High School, which was always probably best people from a rugby family background, myself and Gary Conley were at high school together. So we grew up playing both sports, which was particularly in those days was always rugby and football. I didn't pick up a rugby ball at the age of 12. Gary Conley was the same as well. Both of us were, believe it or not, were footballers before that. We played representative football together in different teams. I played left back or centre half, and Gary Conley was a box to box midfield, central midfield player. So that's how we played against. We didn't play in the same club size together, but obviously we played representing St Helens in a variety of different competitions.
So how does the rep stuff work in kids football? Makes I wouldn't have a clue, me. So do you go and do you do trials, and is it through school or through your club?
No, in them days it was obviously it could be either, to be honest. But in them days you play in the league, so the St Helens. We were representing the St Helens League at that time, and that was teams from obviously everybody in St Helens. Rainhill was obviously included in that, and then we played obviously different parts of Merseyside, and obviously when it came to Merseyside Championships and so forth. So like this, all the different leagues within Merseyside would play into the sort of like a Merseyside Champions. I do remember, but the highlight of me for that was my under-14s that we played the Merseyside final against. I think it was against Knowles, it was, to be honest. A lot of kids who played for Western Juniors, which was Stephen Gerrard's old club, played in that league. And I actually scored the winning goal, believe it or not, for what's there in that final when we beat Knowles 2-0 in that final. I only played football until the age of 15. I was in and out and I was at Man City for a bit as well, but failed football. It was never for me. I was a big, strong, physical left back, front centre half. He asked me to be technical. If he wanted me to be Diego Maradona playing football, I think that was far from it. Not exactly what I was built to do. And then I was lucky enough at the time that myself and Gazcon, or Gary Collins, you guys know him as, we picked up a rugby ball at high school, and we were at the same high school as Andy Ayres, who was also with Winnersmith. Richie Ayres was also at the same high school as well. He'd left when I went through, because he's 5 years older than me, even though Richie would probably tell you he's 5 years younger than me. Yeah, exactly. And it's just one of those things. So Andy Ayres always tells me when I see Andy, I still speak to Andy quite frequently, that he wants them to be further. He was 2 years above me at school, but he was always 2 years below me at school. Yeah, he gets away with it because he's still not got grey hair in his head and look at the state of my head. So it's just one of those things where I was quite lucky, but I was actually went to a really, really sporting school in Holland. And it just progressed from that. We just played representative rugby up until the age, schoolboy rugby from the age of 15. And then I was quite fortunate at the age of 16 that I selected for England schoolboys.
Right. So how did you find school, mate, before we kick on with the rugby? Was school something you enjoyed, and how was high school for you?
Yeah, high school for me was good. Obviously, I came out with, in those days, as long as if you came up before GCSEs, or GCEs as it's known in them days, right. I don't know what they call it nowadays, to be quite, even though I've got three kids, they've all left school now. But it literally is, for me, it was just, you came out before, I mean, I just sort of, when I left school, I went into, I used to work for St. Helens Authority, I used to work, believe it or not, in the salaries and wages departments, I used to pay all the councils and all the staff. Before I went, obviously, we should talk about rugby in a minute. I was quite, to get that sort of job, you had to have some sort of decent education. And I enjoyed it. Maths was my main thing, to be fair. Still, yeah, you know, probably people say because I'm tight that I just sit here counting money, but I don't. Trust me, I don't. The wife's very good at spending it.
Right. So, was you playing both sports, or was you playing football and rugby up until a certain age, mate?
Yeah, up until the sort of. Under 15s, I played football. It was all football. I played rugby at school and played representative rugby all the way through school, county level, that is. And then I played county level up until the age of 15. When I was under 15s, I'd play rugby in the morning and football in the afternoon on a Sunday. So obviously my mum and dad would have to carry me and drive me around here, there and everywhere, particularly in them days. I was playing for Blackbrook, obviously rugby for Blackbrook. That's my amateur club. In the morning, so I could be anywhere in Lancashire, and then hurry back and get changed on the way back from the rugby match, and stick on my footy kit on and then my footy boots to go with it as well, because I had to have separate boots for the two different sports. In them days, we used to play rugby, used to wear the fabulous Walsh boots. Remember Walsh boots? Does anybody remember the Walsh boots?
The ankle ones.
No, not the boot ones. But it was like a football shape one, but they'd be like a handmade boot. Which was out to buy them. There's a special sports store in St. Helens that used to sell them all. I think the manufacturer used to, in those days, man. Andy Gregg used to wear them at that particular time. It was like a special boot that it had a sole, but it had a leather piece in it, so it had really, really flexible sole. So it was brilliant, obviously, with the longer studs, so it was brilliant for playing rugby. For anybody of my generation, if you mention the word Walsh boots, you just see a big smile because you know exactly what I'm talking about. We all wore them. But it was kangaroo leather because they were handmade. They were a fantastic bit of kit. So them in the morning, and a pair of Adidas or Puma King in the afternoon. So that's them that and spraying footy in the afternoon. So that was me up until the age of 15. I had to make a choice. I was advised to make a choice because at that particular time there was a number of rugby clubs that were or professional clubs were already showing interest. Somebody who was one of the main scouts for Widnes at that particular time advised me that I needed to give the football up. And concentrate on the rugby, because if I did that, I'd probably sign my first pro contract within 12 months. And believe it, taking that advice, my family took that advice, or I should say my dad took that advice pretty seriously. Again, because you're guided by your parents at that age. I was quite lucky in that respect. And yet within 12 months, I'd signed my first contract, even though at the time you had to turn 17 to sign your first pro contract. I was still at high school, but it just started to prefer for me GCSEs. I hadn't been picked for England at the time. It was around about January, February time when Widnes came around to my house with the contract. After meeting myself and David Myers, who was also playing, who's a Widnes lad, who played the majority of his kid at so his majority of his rugby with the Tigers. But that year came to play at Blackbrook because myself, right. Gary, him came out the same team. And he wants an interview first. So he went in first. I think it was one Tuesday night to train. I think David went in at 6 o'clock. And then I went in at 7 o'clock. Everything was agreed. And they came round to our houses. And then contracts were signed and hid away in Big Jim's chair.
Hey, so going back to County Rugby, sorry, at school, Jace, do you remember the selection process, mate?
Yeah, so at school, you would go for like anything. Kids from all over the northwest of England would come to selection of trials, and you would go through one particular trial. If you got through that, then you'd be invited back to another. And then if you got through two initial trials, then you'd be invited back to a final trial where the county squad was selected on that basis. It was pretty much. I mean, I think, well, certainly I know when I was under 16s, I'd actually broke my arm in the summer before the under 16s trial. So I actually, when my arm was in a plaster, I actually I broke my wrist. So this is, I actually cut my dad cut the plaster off my arm so I could do the final trial. And we just strapped it up to the class and I managed to get through. It was only afterwards, later, because not only the county trials, but obviously England selectors were at those trials as well, that when years by years, when you go up, and because we're quite lucky enough to meet people years after the event, they said you were already in the England squad after the final county trial. So the fact that I actually cut the actual the plaster off my arm, if I hadn't done that, I would never have got picked for England.
But yeah, and it's the hindsight, mate, and it's just that fine margin.
And sport is fine margin, no matter what level it is. Sport is very much fine margin, and sort of. But it's also it's the knock-on effect that I hadn't have done that and took that risk. I wasn't in any pain by any stretch. So before anybody up there with parents, no parental guidance. So we knew it was virtually healed. It's the fact that there was no risk taken. So there was no pain. So child cruelty or anything like that. Don't worry about things like that. Before anybody wants to point that finger at my parents. But it literally was on that principle. It was just a case of, if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't got picked for England, I probably wouldn't have signed my first contract with us. And that was right. So that one event, the chain of events on that basis, when you look back in hindsight, it was pretty, certainly for my life, because obviously we'll talk about what happened later, but in my life, that one, without that one bit, nothing else in my life probably would have happened.
Yeah, well, it's pretty big, really, isn't it, when you put it like that?
Yeah.
So when you go on this tour, mate, how is it for you, and logistically, how does it work? And do you find out by letter, the old school way?
No,
the
school is a bit. Well, in English school, it used to be down by the school would be informed that basically you've been selected for England. So the school was notified, and then obviously through the PE department in that respect. That's how it was done. Certainly in my day, when I went on, we'll talk about it later on, when I played under 19s Great Britain for Barla, for example, it was mostly old school, you used to get a letter through the public squad, name selected, and congratulating. So for the likes of certainly some of the witness kids, like Darren O'Brien, Peter Alderton, to be fair, so Keith Horribin is another one, to be fair, another one of the witness kids from my era, he got picked in the under 19 squads. We all got... because we have a WhatsApp group for that under 19s team. So literally, it's the 31st anniversary of that tour, which we were talking off-road about it this year. It's interesting because Peter posts pictures of obviously from that. We've all got like nicely coloured hair and skinny and fit and everything else that goes with 18 and 19 year old boys at the time, to be fair. But no, the old fashioned letters, I don't even know. I mean, my mum still has boxes of stuff in her loft at home, to be quite honest. I don't even see it, to be quite honest, but literally, I don't know if I've still got the letters. No, I tended to try to keep them as a kid. He tried to keep as many things as you possibly can, but I haven't seen him. Only for Peter posting it on our WhatsApp group.
Right. No, it's class that he's all staying in touch as well, like we said, even after all this time. And
so, I mean, if you look at the people that went on that, just slightly on that thought, so myself, Chris Wood, Gary Chambers, who's the director of rugby at Warrington Wolves. And if any Wigan fans listen, they're probably curse and swear when I mention the name Warrington Wolves. Then you've got Alan Hunt, Gary Connolly. Then you've got Tommy Martin was on that tour as well. Paul Fletcher, who's the big, robust, no-nonsense second row that played for Hunky. I think he played, spent his whole career there. He's in the Hall of Fame. Fletcher's a real, real character. And then you've got Sean Brown, he played scrum half for Salford. You've got Neil Flanagan, who played scrum half for Oldham, was on the, also on that tour as well. So it's quite, when really, Paul Derbyshire, God rest his soul, is no longer with us. He's obviously, he was at Warrington Wolves, and then the likes of Carl Marriott, who played a lot of the time before, he's no longer with us as well, God rest his soul. He was at Rochdale, so there's a lot of that. And then you've got the Cumbrian boys, who basically all played between Workington and Whitehaven, to be fair. So you've got all those boys as well. Up there as well. So no, our team, I mean Darren O'Brien and Peter Adams have played the Saints, so not then to refer the two witness kids. So our squad was pretty special. A lot of the boys who went on that squad had long distinguished careers. But the meetups are quite unique because we look at the pictures of when we were sort of 18, 19 on that, and we still talk about that talk. It's like, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to tell you certain things, but when you're 18-year-old boy and you're away in Australia, nobody will keep that there, as you can imagine. All the boys are single as well, to be fair, as well. And
yeah.
You've got the bright lights of Sydney, to be fair, and you're having a look like, you have a good look around King's Cross in Sydney, to be fair. I'll leave it at that. And then you can imagine, so you 18-year-old boys will be 18-year-old boys.
Yeah. So for viewers and listeners that might not know, King's Cross is like Blackpool on speed.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, so like leave that to a minute, mate. So do you know when you go back to your club then, Jason, you're hitting these markers, even like, I know you said you picked up a rugby ball quite in your mid-teens. Does it highlight you as a player that people want to target?
In what respect do you mean by that?
As in, so say a lad's not hitting them markers but can handle himself a little bit. Did you find yourself on the back end of a bit of treatment than that because you're a rep player?
Yeah, you always will do, to be fair. I played in the school boys. And once I finished high school, for example, I went and played in Australia. So I went and played senior rugby in Australia. So I'd signed my contract. So we're tied with a contract with Widnes. So what Widnes agreed to do in my off-season was junior rugby and big boys and senior rugby as regards men rugby is very, very different. So I went and played up in North Queensland in Townsville. So we played in the North Queensland competition. As a 16-year-old playing with men, but also playing junior rugby as well. Real eye-opener. It was a real...
So how was that? Yeah.
Being the only English... Oh, because I class myself as Welsh, but the only British man in playing in the competition. You know what Aussies and Poms are like, to be fair, when he got there? So I was walking around with a tag to my head anyway, to be fair. So I got some treatments, and just that to get used to the fact that that's part and parcel of what that treatment is. For me, it was character building because it literally is on that respect. It's just sink or swim time. You accept it and go through the barrier. And it said me, it probably, when I came back to Widnes and the ups and downs I had when I was at Widnes, it literally said me in good stead because it just made me more determined than ever to actually just to continue that, even though I had. So it was just, it was the perfect grounding for me. As well as to be fair, I have to say this, when I was playing reserve team rugby at Widnes, it literally was for me, it was. I had a brilliant 18 coach by the name of Colin Tyra. He was one of them. He knew there was so many talented kids, but he just wouldn't throw them in. And then he'd throw them in, bring them out, throw them in, dip the toe, throw them out. So they'd gain that experience when they were physically and mentally ready to sort of say, right, off you go. And I had that experience both in Australia as a 16-year-old, because obviously I was coached over there by an Australian great, which was a gentleman by the name of Rod Redder. His nickname was Rocket Redder. Then he was a second row. I was a loose forward in them days. So I played second row, stroke loose forward. So I had the perfect coach who looked after me. He made me play. I'd play A grade rugby with the men some days. And then this week, I'll give you a break. Go and play in the under 19s, even as a 16-year-old. But the level of the under 19s over there was so high because there were so many talented kids that were doing it. In fact, I played with, I believe it or not, so I know Gordon Tallis. Everybody knows Gordon Tallis, who obviously played second row for Australia. He's older brother. I actually played in the same junior team as his older brother, under 19s. Gordon was a little snotty nosed kid at the time, to be fair, that was just like cheeky little sod that was just like that, he knew everything, and everybody just used to walk around just throwing a ball in his hands. He had brilliant hand skills as a kid. I thought this kid's going to be a halfback, end up being second row and just like being fourth for Australia. But he was put on, then went to play against him in the World Cup semi final back in 2000. It was quite ironic. The players were laughing about it on the field because obviously we both played for the same junior, we both came through the same junior club in Australia. So it was one of those things we were laughing and giggling about it afterwards, not during the game, by the way. World Cup semi final at the time. So literally, it's just night, the spots won't give you, brings you to the you're slightly backtracking, but when you speak to them, we talk even at kids, and we still have to talk about the under-19s boys, move up to that side of it. And even now, when you look back to before, you still have conversations by social media, is brilliant nowadays, and even podcasts and things like that, to before, you still be able to sort of communicate and catch up to the it's fantastic. It's as if you've never been away for 20, 30 years, then the last time you've seen each other.
That's it, mate. And do you think more like kids should do that avenue? Go and test themselves a little bit and stuff?
Yeah, I think you see a lot of the kids nowadays, I think because there's limited opportunities in the UK, you tend to see a lot of kids, and I certainly see a lot of, I think Tommy Martin's boys over in playing junior rugby or country rugby, it's known of us over there in Australia. So Tommy was at St. His boy was at St. Helens, has gone to that. There's more and more kids. I think Bobby Goulden, well, I think Bobby Goulden's oldest boy is playing.
A couple of them did, yeah.
I played junior rugby over in Australia as well, so now. So, yeah, it's about life skills and opportunities, and depending which avenue you go down. I did it at the age of 16 as a 16 year old. When over as a kid came back as a man, that's the, I always said that, that's what happened to me. So I would advise any junior that would have got that opportunity to grab it with both hands and take it. And then the other side of things, I could play reserve team football, and you don't even see in Super League now, there's a first team squad, and that's it. Does anybody come through the junior league? It's very, very rare that anybody comes through the system. There's one kid who lives around the kid who's a witness kid called Harry Roberts. He went to school, my youngest, he's 17, he's in the academy. I know there's big things expected of him. But I would suspect him to be fair, because that kid's pretty special. Witness kid playing for Widnes. When you've got Widnes down the road looking for players, it doesn't sit right, does it, to be quite honest?
It's mad, mate. It's crazy. And imagine how many kids slip the net, Jace, because of that.
Yeah, Lewis Dodd's another one, plays scrum half at St. Helens.
Yeah.
It's the name, but another one, to be quite honest. It's quite funny when you know you're getting old, when you watch Thingy Wells with the players fullback for St. Helens, and I played junior rugby with his dad, Mark. So you know you're getting old.
So what type of loose forward was your mate? Was you the hybrid, like not just the middle, but could play a little bit? What was your job role at 13?
I was a wide running attacking loose forward, to be fair. Don't get me wrong, I could hold my own. It's probably why the easier when later in my career I moved out into the centres, and then obviously on the wing as well, to be fair as well, because guys would do what they do down the middle. I did that side of it as well when needed to, when it was getting tough. But I was well, scrum in the old days, scrum after stand off, give it the loose forward, and then feeding through, and then just, I was a whole runner. I always was, have been a whole runner. So I literally just, and the best person I ever played with was a guy called Tony Myler. And Tony played with Tony, and Tony's just step, but he said, Tony, where do you want to go? Well, I hit a hole and I'll find you. Yes, and Harris was the same as well. And I, sort of that's the type of loose forward I was. I was up and hit a hole and create space, or rather finish myself off or put somebody else in. And that literally what my great strength was. Later on in my career, I was the other one where I could still hit a hole, but I'd always be on the end of stuff as well.
Right, mate. So when you come back to Widnes, what's the chat? So are you told what your role's going to be? Because you have come back a man now.
Yeah, no, my role was like anything, to be fair. It was still part of my development. It's like anything, you just get assessed to see where you are as an individual, what your skill set is, where you are mentality was as well. I played one game in the reserves away at Salford back in 1989, straight in the first team squad. Being on the tour, being obviously the 2 years previously, I'd had mates 87 and 88 had been in the off season playing junior rugby and senior rugby in Australia. 89, I went on the tour. So it was all that, them 2 years was all prep for the 89 tour of Australia. When we played against Australia, the likes of Brad Fittler and Jason Taylor, to be fair, with the two halfbacks, but they ain't two. And then obviously everybody's heard of Freddie Fittler. Freddie, the kid, was unbelievable because he played against us and then a year later with the Kangaroo. So that showed you how good he was. As a junior. And then sort of we were sort of, even in that team, myself, Gary Conley, and Alan Hunt, we all went on to obviously to represent Great Britain a different, obviously it went on the Great Britain tours out of that squad. So it's just one of those things where it was all prep for when I got to Widnes, and I did my one game at Widnes. Don't get me wrong, you know, I think I made the debut, the first team debut for Widnes was, I think it was the week after they won the World Club Championship against the Canberra Raiders. And I played, and I got the call to play, and that Dougie Dupree was my shit. I got man of the match that day, to be fair. I was going to leave. We lost, believe it or not, which was a big shock at the time. That was my debut the week after we beat Canberra Raiders in the World Championships. World Club Championships.
So what was it being around Widnes at that time, mate? Because obviously that's still a big deal to us, isn't it? The beating Canberra and that.
Absolutely. When you walk in the dressing room, you've got Sorensen, you've got McKenzie, you've got Grimmer, you've got Moriarty, you've got Richie Ears, you've got Emosi Coloto. These are the people I was competing against, by the way, to get in the team. And then you've got Paul Hugh, and then you got likes of Paul Hugh and Les Holliday, Derek Pike. There has to be, obviously, you talk about a lot of guys that everyone's an international, everyone's a senior pro. And then coming through the system at that particular time, you've got myself, you've got Dave Smith, you've got Steve McCurry, all back rowers, all vying for those positions, as well as kids coming through the system. It literally was the actual club was in such a strong position, health-wise, player-wise. I think when I even now with the new technology, you watch some of YouTube and some of the old games from that era, and some of the rugby that team played. And in the backs, you've got Tony Miles, you've got Dave Hume, you've got Jonathan Davis, you've got John Devereaux, you've got Darren Wright, you've got Andy Collier, you've got Rick Thackeray from the Watson when he was the Watson. Rick was a real character to refer it. And then you've got Alan Tate, and you hear Jonathan Davis, you go on and on and on about the names, the depth in that squad. Martin Afire, I didn't even mention him to me because I saw Martin a few weeks back at the Lions Den, and you've got Martin thrown in that as well. And as a kid growing up, and the ability that those kids have, and you've got the professors and the likes of Paul and David Hume and Tony Myler, who were setting standards on a daily basis. It was all about, it's like culture and environments, the key word, whether it be in business or whether it be in sports, all about culture and environments. Culture was so good. Don't get me wrong, we worked really, really hard, but we also played hard as well, as you voluntarily know, in that time as well. So it was just one of those things where, literally, sprint training with Jonathan Davis, Martin Afire, Alan Tate, the name, but two, like, yeah, keep up with them boys to be fair, best if you can, to be fair. You might have been in second game, but still keep up with them sort of scenario. And it was just the culture around the place. Was just Dougie, that was one thing good Dougie was. He might not have been the best coach, and he was definitely not the best coach, but he could put a team together that would express themselves and go, no, don't get me out of basic structure, but when you've got the likes of Dave and Paul Hume and as the people from Widnes call him King Curtin, so people like that, to be fair, honest, who set that sort of level and standard, you know full well that standard had to be maintained and that to be adhered to. And we were quite lucky that our schooling as a 16-year-old for likes of, you know, even Carl Hammond was at most as a kid coming through at the time, and people like that, with it just was the Paul Aitchen, who's my best man at my wedding, to the prayer pack, still a really good close friend of mine. It literally is, to be fair, that sort of level and standard of player that was coming through. We had the right sort of culture and standard that we had to adhere to and was set for us. So it was brilliant. It was fantastic. Best schooling ever. About second to none. Because
it was golden time, Jace, wasn't it?
When you look back, I left because, We'll go into that in a second while left wing is going to show that's one of your questions. But literally, it's moving. But that particular time, when it was finances, when the club hit financial trouble, when players had to disappear and leave because of it, it was so sad. Because the team was built, both the current team, and then that A team I played in, that 11 internationals, that full internationals that graduated, that 11 full internationals. So the next team that was already there. But it disappeared because of financial issues, and that's the sad
thing. Remember,
about
like
it.
Barry Dowd said the same.
Yeah.
He said, like, he just sat in a change room full of internationals. He said, and sometimes you probably think you shouldn't be there. And he said the same about Doug as well, that his man management was spot on, but he wasn't the best coach.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah.
No.
It's mad how someone can do that, though, Jason.
It is, and somebody like Dowd is a great example to me, for he never got the recognition that he deserved. Okay, now what a player he was, by the way.
Yeah.
I think one of the, I'll tell this story to you, because literally he's like one of the, he's a big fan of, remember Phil Bennett, who played stand off for Wales in the 70s? Phil Bennett, he'd step off his left foot.
Right.
Remember Phil Bennett? So Phil Bennett was a Welsh stand off, he played rugby union for Wales in the great 70s Welsh team. An unbelievable left foot step. When Barry played that World Cup final, and watching, you see when he puts, when he goes, when he breaks through and he steps off his left foot, he watches him and puts back. I forget, I think it's Darren Wright at the time, he puts him in the dam. When he steps off his left foot, he goes, Bennett! Because that's what he used to mod himself off Phil Bennett. So he's playing in the World Cup final, he's just, Bennett! And then obviously he's training every time he steps his foot, he goes, Bennett! Bennett! Big bloke. Incredibly intelligent man. He's a really successful business career. Not a lot of time for Dowdy, to be fair, but as a footballer, he's a brilliant guy. He's an unbelievable rugby player.
Yeah. No, he was, mate. It was great to chat to. So you touched on it there about leaving Widnes. So talk us through the circumstances and where you went to.
So my last year, like Frank Marlowe had been appointed as, I think Dougie had left. Frank Marlowe had been appointed as coach. I'd actually played, believe it or not, I'd won the year. I think I scored something like, it was 30 or 40 tries or something stupid like that in the A team. I broke through towards the end of the season into as a first team. And I actually played, believe it or not, because I couldn't believe it at the time. Sort of, Frank put me on the wing. I mean, back row, second row, straight forward, playing on the wing. I remember the first game I played on the wing, I think it was against Bradford. I remember this bit because I was marking Henderson Gill. And I'm marking Henderson Gill. I've never played on the wing before in my life. It was like completely like fish out of water. And I was opposite me, Henderson Gill, he remembered from the 88 tour when he runs around the fullback and does the boogie and watched them at Sydney Cricket Ground some grounds. And I'm Mike and Henderson Gill, the Wigan legend. So it was, again, I think he won that day anyway, so it wasn't a problem. It's like anything when you're unsure about it, like you come on, you do the basics, make sure you make all your tackles, don't drop any balls, chase all kicks. Just keep it nice and tidy and like as that, so you don't make any sort of major mistakes. So it was one of those days. But I got pulled in towards the end of the season and told by Frank that they were going to let me go because he didn't think I'd make it as a professional music player on a consistent basis, even though I tore it up at the start. And then so they sold me to myself and Stephen Wynn got swapped. Frank had stepped down. Phil Ladd had come in as coach. Phil Ladd had been advised by other people within the club to sell me and Stephen Wynn. So I was I left. So Phil, being Phil at that particular time, he adhered to that advice. And then within the space of, I think it was roughly about May time, by October, I'd been capped by England. The full international.
When you're not going to make it, innit?
And you're not going to make it. So my pre-season that year was exceptional. I made a lot of sacrifices. I was actually working at the time for St Anne's Council. So I gave up my job, went full-time in the rugby. It took a big gamble. And then it paid off for me because within, like I said, within the time I'd left Widnes, didn't matter to Widnes, to be fair, because they went and played in the Challenge Cup final that year. Against Wigan and lost. I do remember walking down Wembley Way with my girlfriend at the time, which is now my wife. We walked down Wembley. I was on a bus with a load of Wigan supporters, and I did get quite a lot of stick walking down Wembley Way, as you can imagine that day, which I did laugh and giggle about at the time. But the fact that, you know, we ain't missing you, Chris. Yeah, well, they were at Wembley. I said, no, you're not missing me. So I'll come back and haunt you. And I did.
Yeah.
Of all the clubs I played against, I think I've scored 22 tries against Widnes of all the clubs that went once and left. I think when I was at Keith, I think I scored 6 in one game.
I was going to touch on it, mate. Yeah. So regardless of who you were playing for, was due to that comment, mate, was that always a game you targeted?
For me, very much so. Even though I'm a St. Helens kid, Widnes was my team. I supported my team. I used to live in St. Helens, close to Widnes than what it was to St. Helens. So it was my dad would always take me to go and watch TPL or Mick Adams. So they were all my heroes as a kid. And that's who I would want. When I had the choice of 6 clubs and Widnes came knocking as a kid, it was a no-brainer for me because that's the club I always wanted to play for. But it literally, so for me to be then, obviously 5 years into my contract, it literally to be told that I wasn't good enough to be professional, but it was just the motivation I needed, to be quite honest, because like I said, within a few months of leaving, sometimes it's like I always said to kids, like sometimes you've got to take a step backwards, take 2 steps forward. It was a prime example for me, that, to be honest, because then I went on to play over 100 games for Salford, scored. I scored 1 in every 2 in a team that was in the bottom half of the Division 1 at the time. So it worked its way. And then I got a contract to go and play for Western Reds in the NRL.
Right. So how was Salford, mate? So was it a good enough platform for you to enjoy yourself, hence why England selection come along?
Yeah, I mean, I was quite lucky. Being a selection, it was never something that sort of it happens. I mean, the fact that I've got 1 England cap and I've got my shirt on the wall, by the way, and then I've got 11 caps for Wales as well. I mean, in those particular times, people said, well, how can you play for England and how can you play for Wales? Well, at that particular time, the real state that I had to be, it was a place of birth. And then 12 months after that, they said the rule changed where it became into family heritage. So I immediately changed. Once that happened, I immediately changed my allegiance from England to Wales. Straight away, and then obviously I was involved in squad and so forth as well. Moving from that, moving forward, and games when Wales had games, but like I said, Wales in those days was Jonathan Davis and the rest of the team, John Devereux, David Young, obviously was one of my teammates at Salford to be fair as well. Obviously went to the catch. I missed the '95 World Cup because I had eye socket and cheekbone reconstruction, so I was injured. So that was obviously that was a painful time for me because it was something I was really looking forward to at that particular time. So, but when you face, well, I look like even more so, I look like Quasimodo in them days to be further than I do now. And it literally, to be quite honest, it's just one of those things you've just got to accept.
You touched on before about, sorry to interrupt, mate, you touched on before how proud you was and you class yourself as Welsh. So yeah. If that rule was always heritage, you would never have played for England, would you?
No, absolutely no chance. I mean, it's a bone of discussion. My kids accept, my wife will never accept that, so she doesn't accept the Welsh side of who I am. She still says I'm English, so but it's like anything. I think she does it to try and wind me up, to be quite honest. My kids accept it. So for example, if there's a rugby union game on, to be fair, like there is at the weekend, to be fair, we will sit and watch and support Wales. We will support England, and my kids will do exactly the same. They'll support Wales as well, knowing full well that what my which might sound a little bit strange, because they are English. I make no bones, they are English. But when it comes to rugby, it's anybody but England.
Right. So. What happened? So you were top try scorer for Salford at one point as well, mate, weren't you? Like you said, you were like 1 in every 2. Did it work out?
Yeah, I think 1 year, I think it was 3rd or 4th in the country. I think 3 years I was at Salford, I think it was player of the year twice, and I was top try scorer in one of the other years, to be quite honest as well. So my 3 years at Salford was fantastic. I was coached by Kevin Tamati. He got me something to Salford. And then Jimmy Jack or Gary Jack, who I still speak to on social media, but I still exchange messages. Like, Jimmy was my coach. Great bloke. Tighter than cramp. Oh, mate, you never get him anywhere near a bar, to be fair. He's the most tightest man I've ever known in my life, to be fair. He had more money than any of us, to be fair. He just, his idea of buying a round of drinks was basically 35 halves of lager. That's basically what his idea was. Very tighter than cramp. And he literally is, to be fair. Jimmy, great bloke. So Jimmy was the coach. I had a really, really strong relationship with Jimmy. And then Jimmy got the sack and they appointed Andy Gregory and it was time for me to leave. And that's why I left Salford.
Yeah. So you mentioned then you got player of the year twice as well.
I think so, yeah, out there.
Yeah.
So I played the year in the A team at Widnes, played the year a couple of years at Salford. So, I mean, and then I must have been doing something right because obviously scouts came over from the Anna round. In that day, the Super League war was about to break out. I'd already agreed to go to the Western Red based over in Perth. So I'd agreed. So I had with a further 12-month contract. And just before I married my wife, who's wife Donna, who's from Widnes. She'll never leave Widnes. So literally, I've only got out of Widnes twice. I'll tell you that. And one was to go to Australia to play in the NRL. And it literally is for me. Sort of, we that's what we were going to do. But my oldest boy, who's 29, we talked about who's my oldest boy, Scott, was 6 months old at the time. We just got married before he came out of Austria. Obviously moved out, so we brought the wedding forward, knowing full well we agreed to go obviously to go and play to move to Australia. But my wife got homesick very, very quickly over there, so I had to sort of scrap the last 12 months of my NRL contract because obviously. And though even 24 stroke 25, family comes first, irrespective of what my opinion. I wasn't going to stay out there just for the kids. My wife and my oldest boy, Scott, would be back in the UK because she's desperate to come home. It's not the days when we have now where you have Facebook and there was none of that.
Oh, that's it, mate.
You had none of that before in them days. It just was the telephone, that's it. There's no face to face video calls or nothing like that. So I decided to come back. So I assessed which was the best offer for me. And people said to me when I came back, why did you come back and drop down a division? I was sold so much and it was one of the best decisions I ever made career-wise. I was so, because Phil Larder was the coach and Phil said he made the biggest decision, one of the biggest decisions, worst decisions he ever made was selling me. So he cost him £110,000 to buy me back. I literally on that. I went to Keith the Cougars when I could have signed for a number of other clubs within Super League at that time. The Super League had just started. One of the best decisions I ever made. Not because the quality of the rugby was the same as what we were getting in Super League at that particular time. But I was playing for I was part of Cougar Mania, which at that time was literally, it was just such a special time. My old mate Andy Ayres was there as well. So I played with Darrell Powell, Nick Pinkney was part of the back line I was in. Andre Stupak played fullback for Wigan, was part of that as well, to be honest as well. So we had Dallas Fleer, we played in the second row. Grant Doherty, there was loads of Jason Ramshaw, Marty Wood, who played for England as well, playing his forward. So we had loads of top class players playing in that side. So that's why I went. It's just unfortunate the two seasons that I was there, A, they hit financial trouble again. I mean, don't get me wrong, I was down quite a lot of money in those days. So I was getting pretty decent wages, but also as well, they literally, we was all geared to getting promotion. And we weren't, the two seasons we had a really bad stretch of injuries. So Nick Pinkney was like, I played in the Premiership final with like a reserve team basically, and we still only just got beaten in a Premiership final at Old Trafford. And that's the reason. And the financial, I got picked for the Lions. I played for Wales in the European Championship, then got picked for the Lions tour to Papua New Guinea, Fiji, and New Zealand back in '96. So people said to me, "Why did you do it?" Well, it didn't stop me playing representative honours and at the highest level, playing in that division. I think I was third top highest scorer in the country. I scored 35 and 25 games that year for the Kickley to be first. So It was what it was, to be quite honest. So I was quite lucky in that respect. And then I came back just before I left. I came back to the UK with a smashed up knee from the tour. I had an operation on my knee, and then all hell broke loose because financially they were virtually bankrupt. So I got sold to Castleford Tigers.
Right, mate. So the NRL club that you went to, mate, what was that chat like when you said I need to go home? How accommodating were they all unaccommodating?
Anything like that, to be fair, listen, it was a pretty easy conversation. To be fair to Pete Mulholland, and unfortunately he's no longer with us, he only died of cancer a couple of years back now, to further the coach. Great bloke. So Skull was his nickname. So Skull was an incredibly, really, really good bloke. Fully understand, because he knew I was getting, we were in constant contact with each other before I actually got out there. He knew, obviously, so there was myself, Craig Innes, Barry John Mather, Brendan Tutor. So the guys who played in Division One, who would watch them, we were all going over anyway to look for a Dio Powell, who was at Wakefield as well, was with us as well. So there was five of us that were all coming up from the UK. And it was really, really cool. He knew full well that I was still 24, still 25, still young. I like I said, a 6-month-old baby with Scott, who's my oldest, 29 now, and then obviously my wife Donna as well. And it was one of those things where we just made a decision, which was. He knew I was never going to stay over there without my family, and my family had already gone back because she knew that she was homesick. And it was a sensible decision. It's like anything, as a human, forget the contractual side of things, the human element does come into it. And I was lucky
Make
enough
sure.
that I was, yeah, exactly right. And I was lucky enough that I had a coach who was incredibly sympathetic to those circumstances and was quite. He was disappointed that I went back. Obviously, we'd spent a lot of time in recruiting and scouting, everything that goes with it as well. And when you go overseas, I think house, car, everything that goes with it as well, to be fair. So it's not exactly something that you think likely. There's a lot of planning that goes on in the background, to be fair. But it was the right, for me, it was the right thing to do. And we proved right then. And Skull, God rest his soul, is no longer with us. But there's a lot of people who think that harder than. And MG Matt Guy was our biggest sign. MG played in the second row for us. Our class marker was a little bit old school when he played. He was the one that had the fight with Wally Lewis in the State of Origin back a couple of years earlier, to be fair. I think that's one of the most famous parts when the referees separated the program and they were walking off the pitch at half time and just wanted to kill each other.
So, do you know when you move, mate, and there's a transfer fee involved, which tended to happen with you, Jason? That is that extra pressure, mate, or do you just go and play your rugby because they've bought you for a reason type thing?
The first thing everybody has said to me when it comes to transfers is, the rugby players get a cut of the transfer fee, and the first question they say is no. So there's no precedent. So for me, there was no pressure on me. I couldn't, because I spent 400 pounds. I really didn't care, to be honest, because let's see, between the two clubs, there's not, for me, I just considered that was a transaction between the two clubs. I'm bought there for a certain reason, to play a certain way and just get on with the job. And that's all I ever did was just, no matter what it was, to be fair, was just to get on with the job. My job was to play at my optimum ability, and obviously because then I was playing in the outside back, just to score tries, and that's what the club wanted me to do.
I was cash, mate.
Gas was brilliant. I mean, I was quite lucky. I had a centre partnership with a guy called Adrian Bowles, who obviously went on to win Man of Steel a few years later when he because he switched positions from. So when I joined Casper, they'd lost, I think it was the first 12 games, and they were bottom of the league. And then we managed in my first season to, I think we finished eighth. And then went, it was the year Bradford won the league. And then we played in the Premiership. So we finished eighth in Bradford top. We went to Bradford, beat Bradford at Bradford. And then we went to St Andrews in the semi finals and just narrowly lost the Saints in the semi finals. So for us, and that year we played in the World Cup Championship, which I have to say was the best holiday I've ever experienced in my life, to be fair. But if you want to know about that, we were in Australia for 16 days. I think we were sober for four. It's the best lads' holiday I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we couldn't win because the reason why that what people say, well, that's not a little bit unprofessional, I suppose, yeah, it is. But when you're in a cooker box like we were in so much pressure, A, we had to fight to stay in Super League. wasn't the priority. So the priority of the club was to stay in Super League. The World Cup Championship was seen as a boosted bonus for us. Like we weren't going to win the Challenge Cup that year, and we weren't going to do anything else. So it was just priority to stay in Super League. So for us, to be fair to Stuart Raper, who was the coach at the time, Stuart took that as a bit of a bonding stroke, fitness stroke, get together type scenario. So so we were over there. That was the purpose of what our trip was. We had fixtures to fulfill. We did all right, actually, to be fair. We didn't get hammered in any of the games. We were incredibly competitive. So we played against Hunter Marys and my old club, believe it or not, Perth Red, Western Red. So we played those two games. But what he did do, to be fair, people always said to me, how come Barry John Mather, who's signed up at Perth Reds, come back and sign for Casper Tigers? Yeah, because Stuart Raper sent me on a mission to make sure that I got persuaded Barry John Mather to leave Perth. It's three-story penthouse apartment in the centre of Perth. You see something you see on a movie set with his, at that particular time, with his glamorous girlfriend, which is not his wife, he's got a separate wife now, but to move back to the UK to live in Castleford.
The beach must have been as good, eh?
Leon Price said, give me Blackpool Beach instead of Bondi. Yeah. Is that what it is? The canal of Castleford to the actual beaches of Perth.
So it's really, mate, then, when you're under a pump, it's them experiences, though, that pull you through, isn't it?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. It's like anything to be put in them days. It's still incredibly professional. But we had fun at the same time. And the reason why we had fun, it's like anything to put, and I'll talk about the Welsh one. The Welsh motto was always work hard, play hard. We worked really, really hard. And we were locked behind closed doors. But when it was time to have fun, we had fun. And it was we always found that right balance. And to be fair, Stuart Raper that year, Shane Flanagan was his assistant, who's now the coach of St George Illawarra, the Dragons, in the NRL. And we had fantastic coaches, we had some fantastic players. And it literally, on that particular stage, we just wanted to, he just wanted to make sure that we were in Super League next year. That was his primary goal, and we achieved that at the end of the season with an absolute canter. Where in theory we should have got to the Premiership final, we just went out of steam because the priority had been up. So then the opposite. On my second year, Cass was brilliant because obviously the influx of obviously new players, PJ being one of them. The second year is always a little bit of boxing because obviously we were convincing we got to the playoffs again. And then that year, we in the Challenge Cup, we beat Leeds at Leeds. I think if everybody remembers, any Castle fans that are watching this, if you get to watch it, when Adrian Vowles does a Hail Mary bomb in the last dying second of the game, and Andrew Schick comes down and we all go berserk. I think we're jumping in the crowd and everything that particular. And then the Utah goes after that. It's one of those amazing things you see after the game. Yeah. You're like, you couldn't sleep that night for 2 nights, couldn't sleep because you're just living off adrenaline. Even us, we all get that now as well. Still think about it. Still gets me excited about. Then we beat Bradford in the next round of the Challenge Cup, who were league champions the year before. And then we draw Sheffield at home. And we just thought we just had to turn up. And then we win in the semi-finals, then in the quarter-finals, and Sheffield beat us at home. It's the nearest they ever got to winning the Challenge Cup. And literally, that year, when we talked about that year, we just said we threw it away. We should have got to the Challenge Cup finals. And we were good enough. We had the right side as well to do it as well. It's one of those life stories where you just think, what if? But it is what it is, to be honest.
I don't think you've got many of them, though, mate, have you? You can be really content so far, what we spoke about.
Absolutely. If you'd have asked that snotty 12-year-old kid when he was at high school that picks up the rugby ball and did what he did to the player, then he goes, he fast forward 20 years and he looks back at what happened to the player, then he really can't complain.
Right. And when did... you flirt with rugby union because you went to Newport as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So my thing with Newport was sort of I was coming toward two aspects to this why I ended up switching codes. I'd had a bit of a rumor anyway. Obviously, WRU did. I'd had a few inquiries while I was at Cat, and I was coming toward them. My contract ended at Casper. So my first priority, being brutally honest, was to extend my contract to Cat, and my agent at the time was doing it. Completely messed it up, and I got some real bad advice to the stage where I'd agreed a contract and then he got pulled. by Castleford because the agents had messed it up. So it wasn't actually me scrubbing around to find something because I had other offers, but I thought to myself, at that particular time, it was 1998, I was 28 years of age. It was, if I was going to make the jump to do it, it was then or never, because I was at the right age to do it. And I thought, I'd never played rugby union before ever. The only time I'd ever played it, believe it or not, was I played it as a 15-stroke, 16-year-old kid. I'd played a couple of games in the vets team at West Park, believe it or not, to the first. My dad played in the vets team at Park, so I played with my dad at that sort of a couple of games doing that. So no experience of rugby union whatsoever at all. I got a decent offer sort of to go to sort of the WRU were pointing me to come. So this, when I went down to see Graham Henry was the coach at the time, I said, where do you want to go? Where do you want to play for? Obviously, I said Cardiff. So they put me at Newport. So Anthony Sullen went to meet Cardiff and I went to Newport, which was bottom of the league. And the boys were brilliant, don't get me wrong. It's quite lucky because we'll talk into that later, because I went at that time that I met a guy called, a young number eight who went up to play for Wales. It was a guy called Alex Popper, who was 18 at the time. He was playing first team at Newport. And we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about how that's significant later on. And it literally is. So I went to training sessions. They played me a game in the European Club Championship against Steaua Bucharest. That was my first game. They put me on the wing. I touched the ball three times, made two tackles, and then I probably had a blinder. I couldn't understand it. I didn't get it. I wasn't enjoying it. If I look back, I just wasn't enjoying it. Just didn't get any action. It's just, if you're playing, I just can't, you're constantly involved in something I got used to. Yeah. I remember playing in a Welsh Cup competition, a place called Llanharan in Wales, which is up in the valley somewhere. It rained like, biblical rain. The pitch didn't have any grass bits whatsoever. The changing room, the water was leaking from the dressing room. I've been used to playing in, obviously, there were lots of them. I looked around in this dressing room and there was like mold in one corner, and the ceiling's falling down, there's water coming through the ceiling. And I look at this one, did this when I was like 10 years ago when I was an amateur. Like, what am I doing here? And then we played in the Moxham. We got beat. It was a shock in the competition that we got knocked out of the Welsh Cup. And I looked at him and just went, this is not for me. And then, so we agreed sort of to part ways. And then I came back to Widnes, which is probably the worst decision I ever made. I came back as a second time and signed for Widnes and played under Colin Wakefield. Paul Ewan was there. He still was with the captain of the team as well. He was coming towards the end of his career. It was the worst. It was honestly 98 that he came back and played those shots because I had the pressure of, I was expected to get them up, but I was been behind that pressure to prepare because we were playing in the championship at the time. Colin Wakefield, he was a lovely bloke, but couldn't coach with Soffa. Was a really, really nice guy, to be quite honest. I just couldn't do it. And I just, it was just the wrong career decision for me to come back. And in the meantime, because of what, obviously, I had an offer then to go back to rugby and to go and sign for the biggest club in England, which was Leicester Tigers. And I just couldn't turn that down. And then more in 2 months at Leicester than I did in my whole time. Playing rugby union. And I played at Leicester Tigers and then I was there for one season and then came back. I was put on loan to Manchester because I was commuting backwards and forwards from Widnes to Leicester for training and so forth from that time. I went and played because it was all, training's great and so forth, but if you're not playing regular games, it was a nightmare. I was involved in the Leicester squad, which was 40 players. 28 of those were full internationals, including myself. Yeah. None of us, you just never guaranteed you weren't going to play in a week. I went and played at Manchester, we were playing in the Championship or the League or the Premiership in Rugby Union, so it was still high level Rugby Union. And enjoyed my time there. And then went back, and while I was at Manchester, to be fair, I got a phone call from Pat Griffiths and said that for the World Cup in 2000 and towards that. And Clive said, if you come back and play Super League, if you go box, and that's the reason why I came back and played for Wakefield. So I went to Wakefield to prove that I was still capable of playing at that level. I played eight games for Wakefield. People said, why did I play more than 8 games? So 4 tries in 8 games, so I was still going to be 1 and 2 scoring. Came back, proved myself. I would have stayed longer, but they've been in them days, before Wakefield had something called rubber checks. It just kept bouncing. So I wasn't the only one that stayed. I used to commute with Bobby Golden and stuff. So me and Bobby would drive over to Widnes together. And literally, and that's the reason why. But I'd done my bit at Wakefield. I went back to Leicester. I'd been selected to the World Cup. And then I sat down with Dean Richards again. He's a lovely guy. He said, Dean went, I want you to go back and play in the Rugby World Cup. And I promise you, if you go and play well in the Rugby World Cup, I'll find you a new club. And he did. To be fair to him, this is just saying he did. So I actually played, after playing in the Rugby League World Cup in 2000, which was 6 weeks, which was incredible. We got to the World Cup semi-final, as you know. We should have beaten Australia, but we ran out of steam. There's a reason behind that, but I'm not going to tell you what that is. And sort of, that 6 week period was fantastic. We spent 2 weeks in South Africa on the pre World Cup tour, which was amazing, promoting the game in South Africa. We ended up playing South Africa at the Blue Bulls as well. So we played at Loftus, which was incredible. Players we had, squad we had was brilliant. And the reason why we ran out of steam was A, because of other things, but we also ran out of players. I think Paul Moriarty and John Devereaux, we had to bring them out of retirement to the squad because just literally just ran out of players. Fantastic event to be in. There was no way that Little Wales at that time, everybody was going to beat us, anybody was being ridiculed. We played what we got to the semi final and should have beaten Australia, to be fair. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that game's famous for, I think Sky always put that game on as the one of the golden oldies, to be fair. He's literally from Lee Breeze dropping goals from the halfway line and putting bombs up and catching bombs and scoring on the sticks again, jumping Darren Lockie and people like that, to be fair. No, it was just, he was that famous. And then I got, after that, I went and signed for a club called Dax, which were playing in the top 14 in France. The top 14 in France at that particular time was very much, was very different because it was split into two pools of, it was top 16, but it was two pools of eight. And the top four from each went into the end of season playoffs. We finished fifth in our pool. But I played at Toulouse, Montferrand, which is clear Montferrand. Never forget that one, to be fair. A cold December night in Clermont. And it's not a nice place, by the way, Clermont. Only French, sorry, I apologise if that's it. I was living in Dax, which was on the Atlantic coast. So 10 miles away from Biarritz, within 10 minutes, I could be in Spain or locked in for my day off. I was sitting on the beach one day watching the world go by. That was my life at that time.
Yeah.
And it literally was. There's about 24,000 on the Clermont on a cold December night. And when you see it, when you play in France, what you see in the television, correct, when you've got the band and the box name and all that, it does happen consistently all the time. Dax was a small town of 30,000 people in the town. There's always 10,000 people that would go and watch the rugby at weekends. Oh, it's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. My oldest boy, Scott, went to a French speaking school. The whole thing was just was brilliant. It's just unfortunate that I got a knee injury and that was the end of that. I smashed my knee in and that was the end of that. So I then came back to the UK. I agreed to sign for a club called Rovigo in Italy. So I was going to go to Italy the year after because I thought I was coming towards the end. I knew I was coming towards the end, but I wanted to earn as much money as I possibly can, don't get me wrong, but also I wanted to play overseas. That was the end. I wanted to experience all those different cultures. Because I wanted to go in that particular time, I wanted to go into coaching. So when I stopped playing, I wanted to go into coaching. So playing in different countries and getting different ideas, that was the idea for me. So it's the next, because the way they coach in France is different than the way they coach in England and so forth as well. It was just, I wanted to do that. So 10 days before I was due to go to Italy, the club cancelled the contract because they didn't have the finance to do it. So I have ended up playing a company. I played a club called De La Salle Palmerston in the Irish Premier Division, so the All Ireland Division, first division, where I lived in, which is the same birth in Dublin. My wife and kids were still living in obviously. It was cheaper to get a flight from, in those days, in the early noughties, to get a flight from Liverpool to Dublin. So then me to travel to, I don't know, play for Leicester or somewhere like that, because it was, I used to get flights for like £10 a flight, return flight, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In them days, it was just ridiculous. So we'd book them in advance. My wife would come over, spend time with me in Ireland. I would come home, depending during the week time as well. I was training Tuesday, Thursday, playing Saturday.
Yeah.
So I could literally, at that particular, I was literally, even though I had an apartment in Dublin, I was still just commuting backwards and forwards. It was just a lot easier. And then was and that and that was that. And then I coached at Rugby Lions, and that was me done. I coached at Bracknell,
Yeah.
and I played coach at Bracknell, and that's me done.
Right, and was you content with that, mate? Was that decision easy to make?
For me, I was quite lucky. The last couple of years of me actually playing, progressing from the bubble of professional sports and what I call the real world, I should say, I'd already started. I got a job working for a sports brand called Cookery Sports. So I sort of there was a brand that started in 1999. I was the first area manager for the Midlands. I was coaching in play coach in London, so I could do that. I was part-time coach, part-time doing that job. So I started. So Mike, for me, the transition from the professional era into normal life had already started. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I was ready for it. I always knew at some stage that it was never gonna. I always knew I was gonna retire by 32. I'll stop playing rugby by 32. I stopped when I actually went a year too long, 33, playing wise. That progression had already started for me. The pinnacle for me stopped in 2000 when I played in the World Cup, and I went and played top 14 in France. That was the pinnacle. I reached the top. It wasn't getting any better from that. And obviously, the Lions tour in '96 is the absolute pinnacle. So for me, I'd done what I wanted to do, and then I just sort of the transition to normal life was set and complete. And then my son started. He picked up a my oldest boy picked up a rugby ball, and then he started playing at the Wids on the server. Lots of things. Young sir, he was the coach. He was his coach from the age of six until the age of nine, and then Sarah said she said to me she couldn't do it anymore, so I ended up coaching his team at the Wits, and that was that.
And how do you find that?
I actually no, I really really enjoyed it. It's like anything, you make it as fun as you possibly can. If you speak to some of the boys you know at the Wits, to be fair, coaching wise, I was quite an old school taskmaster as well, because I think we have fun, but you've got to have discipline at the same time as well. And rugby is all about, it's teaching what's right and wrong, no matter what it is. And I always said, I used to say to my kids, even at such a young age, to be fair, they said, I want to do X, Y, and Z. I want to be professional. I said, that's fine. Horrible world, boys, but if you want me, I'll get you there. If you put the effort in, I'll get you there. But those boys were literally used to be, for me, my main goal was just teaching them discipline in their life, to be quite honest, and life skills, to be quite honest. That was the main thing for me. And we had, parents were brilliant. Didn't have any issues with any of the parents as well, down at the Wids as well. So, no, I loved it, but it was, and then I took it so far, and it was time to move on. And I stopped coaching my oldest boy, Scott, when he was, I said, I'd take him to 16, and that's my bit done. And that was it, I was done.
Right, and what's been your life since, Jace? What have you been up to, mate?
So I was involved in the sportswear industry for over 10 years, and I really managed a few sales. I managed a couple of the brands as well. You're probably not going to like what I actually physically do now. A lot of people. So I'm actually in the finance industry, but what I actually do is I work for a company now that it works in enforcement. So in other words, people who don't pay council tax, business rates, anything like that, I manage. So I work with local authorities on collection of unpaid debts. That's what I do as a business now. I was involved in sportswear for a number of years. The one good part of what I do is people that are vulnerable, people that need help, people need assistance. One of the schemes that I have is make sure that people get that help. Don't get me wrong, there are other people. The other side of the coin is that there's two sides of this coin: people who genuinely need help, people who are, and I apologise for the language I'm about to use, but the other side of the coin, people who are scumbags and are playing lots of wankers who rip people off, I go after them guys as well. So that's basically what I do as a, what I do as a job.
Yeah. Right, mate. And your hoodie, so I can see head for change, isn't it, on your hoodie?
Yeah, this is what one of the things I got involved in last year. This time last year, I was in the process of learning how to swim. So I got a phone call back in October 22, as it is now, to say from my mate Alex, who we were talking about previously before, Alex Popham, who's the ex-Welsh number 8, who unfortunately has been diagnosed with dementia. He's in his mid-40s. And he's having experimental treatment to see that. It's pretty prevalent in the news at the moment, certainly about the two codes of rugby I spoke regarding head injuries. I know there's a lot of hoo-ha at the moment, certainly in the rugby league, certainly in the Super League, about head tackles and the game's gone and so forth like that. But when you've seen what I've seen with guys who are involved in the charity Head for Change, who are, there's one guy who's 32, made his debut, played second row for Scotland in the against South Africa, got concussed twice in the game. Doesn't remember any of the game. He's 32 years of age. He's got dementia. His brain could be dead within 10 years. Alex doesn't really want to talk about it. He's in his mid-40s now, but he's having the treatment, which is slowing the dementia side of it down. Cannot remember a single rugby game he played throughout his whole career. And there's 12 of us that did the swim, so it was a league versus union across the lots. This time last year, I was learning how to swim. I couldn't swim. So in October last year, there was a documentary that was released, which is called "Rugby Concussion: The Turning the Tide" for Sky Sports. I advise people to watch that. Particularly, there's a bit where a guy talks about his mate who had dementia, who committed suicide, who had the dementia side of it because he got a bang in the dressing room one game and couldn't find his way out of the dressing room. It's a serious subject. It's a pretty much this is not about the sport, it's about improving the sport and making it safer. It's about giving education to parents and to youngsters who are starting to make the sport safer and make sure that their children are okay. And it's about the guys that are currently who are now suffering from dementia to make sure they get the right treatment and right help to make sure whatever lifespan they've got left, that they have it as best and comfortable as possible. I'm not going to talk about any court cases because it's pretty much they're ongoing in both codes of rugby. I've got no interest in that because I'm not going to prejudice any of those cases. All I want to make sure is that the sport is safer for both codes of rugby, that it's still enjoyable to participate no matter what level you play at. This is what Head for Change is banging the drum about. And they obviously the awareness of that. When you actually sit down with some of these guys who've got dementia and have the conversation with them, you understand why that change has got to come.
Yeah, we get it, mate, don't we? You
Yeah.
don't get the handbook when you sign that power form as a kid, do you? You don't
No,
realise, do you? And
I mean, Kev Brown, who did the swim with us, Kev was our youngest member. I mean, most of the rugby league boys that did him were 50 plus. That was myself, Mick Cassidy, Mickey Edwards, Dennis Betts, Cliff Eccles. We were the guys that said we were all 50 plus. Kev Brown, this research says that if you've had three concussions, that you're supposed to retire. Kev Brown had 38, including one when he played in a World Cup semi-final against Tonga. And he tells me, when he told me that story, to be fair, it was just 38 concussions. We couldn't believe, when he actually said that, we couldn't believe it because, I mean, Kev shows no symptoms now, and fingers crossed, touching wood, that nothing happens in the future. But it literally is on that aspect. It's just we just don't know, and that's the scary part. I'm 53 now. I mean, I'm quite lucky because I'm showing no symptoms, and I say this watch them at the moment. But who knows what might happen to me in the future as well? To be fair, because when you get past you're mate, you're all right. You're lucky to be quite honest, because you're in your 20s to 30s, to be quite honest. Well, is he all
Yeah,
right,
we
mate?
thought, well, mid-30s now, yeah, I have to
Oh,
check then.
mate, mate, John, you're all right, mate. You've been, you just, when we said people like you've been bathing yourself in milk and all of you, you're like Cleopatra, right? You're to be quite honest, mate. But it literally is on, it's just, you've just got to make sure that your generation doesn't suffer from what my generation has been through. The days of getting a bang on the head, shoving a smelling salts under your nose and saying, crack on with it. No, you can't do that anymore. I know Dennis Betts, who did the swim with us, now sits on a committee looking at, certainly in the rugby league circles, regarding that, how to make the game still as enjoyable but safer, as much safer for the boys as well. You just can't take, even if it comes to, it's not necessarily during games, but it's the concussions during training as well.
Yeah.
When I switched codes, I couldn't believe, we used to just kick lumps out of each other, and I couldn't believe it. When I played rugby league in the 90s, we never did any physical, the only physical contact we did was hitting bags. We never sort of did contact against each other.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the rugby union side of it. We used to play something at Leicester called murder ball, which was a 10 by 10 square. One side, throw a ball in the middle and kick lumps out of each other. I know, because you've probably played the same thing. I've done it with my kids' teams, to be fair, when they were there. I regret it so much now. Because literally, it's like, and head guards and shoulder pads, and that make no difference. Head trauma is head trauma. It's literally, it's now, there's no need to have any form of physical contact and training. When you've got, you can do that and still play the sport safely at the weekend. That's my own philosophy anyway. Now, when I look back, that was one of the biggest mistakes I made with my junior with us. So any of those boys are watching it, particularly Mike Jones. I'm sorry, Mike. I didn't mean to do it that last name. It was just the time at the moment, mate. So I do apologize about that.
I think the top level is certainly getting better, and that's filtering in for them, isn't it? The players are quite vocal on the social media now, mate, about limiting that and leaving it to a game day, but doing everything around it to make it safe and stuff.
No,
Right, no,
exactly.
fair enough, mate. And head for change is all over the socials. All they have to do is type it in the search bar, and it'll be there, won't it, mate?
It's look for head for change. The other thing I suggest people do regarding the documentary, so Sky Sports did do an hour documentary. It is on the Sky Sports YouTube channel, so it's Rugby Concussion, Turning the Tide. It's quite an emotional roller coaster. I sort of, obviously, I'm in it quite prominently. My wife and my youngest son's in it as well, to be fair, because he does motor sports. So that was a pretty much, because it's pretty prevalent to them as well, to be quite honest, head trauma, because he races at an elite level in motor sports. So it's just one of those things where you just need to, there's that side of it as well. Hence, it's certainly not at Lewis Hamilton level, because that is one expensive sport. God almighty, that is one expensive sport. But it literally is. Like I said, last year he raced in world championships and so forth, that in Europe last year, and it was just, again, you still get head trauma in that, because of the G-force and everything else that goes with it as well. So it's I'm doing that, just bringing that up, but not necessarily for him, but just sort of his awareness that fact that it could be affected in all sports and all walks of life as well, to be fair. The last thing we need is dementia with young adults like yourself.
No, brilliant, mate. And we will share that on the week building up to your episode as well, mate. I'll be
No, mate, no
highlighting
worries.
the
Yeah.
documentary. So I've got a few daft questions for you, mate,
Go
if
on then.
that's all right now.
This
We're near the end of the chat.
is the best one. This is the best bit, the daft questions bit. Come on, John, this is the best bit.
So any pre-match superstitions when you were playing?
I always put my left sock on before my right sock, and my left boot before my right boot. If I didn't, this and the other one, this is the really strange one. If I didn't get on the massage table first, second, or third before a match, I couldn't play.
Right.
Work that one out.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's just what it is, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's fair enough.
The other quirky thing as well, Sam, I wouldn't let anybody strap me. I had to strap myself.
Oh, all right.
Which, when you've got a physio there and specialist do it, I just wouldn't let anybody do it. I had to do it myself.
Anything that makes yourself comfy and confident in what you're doing, in it's mad, the little, like we've said before, fine margins, isn't it?
That makes no sense whatsoever at all. I played charity matches when I finished, and I still had to put my left boot on before my right boot. And I'd be like, what the fuck are you doing? What are you doing? So it's just routine. Everything I did that just meant that I just couldn't play.
Well, it's not the next. So the
Bonkers.
next word I'm going to say, mate, is different for everybody. The definition, very varied. So the toughest player you played with and against.
Oh, toughest. As regarding physicality wise, or just pure ability?
Well, exactly that. It's different, and it makes however you see the word toughest within the game.
The
See, I've
toughest
let you
player.
down a little bit because I didn't send you these, did I? So.
No, the toughest player. I've got the answer to this for straight away. So the toughest, both physically, mentally, and ability-wise, I'm going to say two.
Okay.
Okay, one is Kevin Ayrault. The other one is Viago Twiggenmalen. So I remember the reason why I said Viago Twiggenmalen. I played against him when he was at Wigan against Salford, and I tackled him 33 times, and I was black and blue for 4 weeks. Because he was, remember England the wingers, he was known as then. He was short, stocky, but it was like hitting a
Yeah.
piece. It was like tackling a piece of cement. It was just like every time he was that hard. It was like hitting a piece of cement. Unfortunately, Biag is no longer with us. God rest his soul. But Kevin Ayrault was known as the beast. I mean, Kev was just a handful. He was just big, strong, physically had everything to be fair. He was just an absolute. It was just a nightmare.
Your favourite away ground, mate, that you played at?
Oh, that's a good one.
Because you're probably not meant to have a favourite away ground, really, are you? You're meant to be uncomfy in that.
No, I'll tell you what it is. I'm going to say Norton Park. Because every time I scored a hat trick once when I came back, one of the first visits I came back to Norton Park, I scored a hat trick. So I'll say Norton Park.
Yeah.
I scored every
Running
time I
out the
came back. I
cage.
played coming out the cage when they used to spit at us. And I'll tell you,
Yeah.
I'll have to tell you this story. The funniest thing, one of the funniest things I've ever said, we're playing this game. I was at Salford, we're playing this game against Widnes one night on a Friday night. So it's on Sky. And obviously, when you come out the cage, obviously in the old stadium, you used to get quite a lot of abuse. Not as bad as the one at Hull when you played at the Boulevard when you come out covered in spit and all sorts of
Read
different stuff. You should
stories
throw
about
stuff
the Boulevard. Yeah.
the Boulevard's there. But this bloke's like he's really, really aggressive with coming out. So this is like second half, start of the second half. I don't know if you can ever see the clip. So this bloke's he's got his face up to the cage. Like Dae Young, David Young's what's his name's leading us out. And he's snarling, what's his name? David Young's like that was for two fingers. What's his name pokes him in the eyes. We're walking past this bloke's rolling around on the floor, to be quite honest, because that young just poked him in the eye. So, you see, he's come up the dressing room, just wetting ourselves. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
So if you could go back and tell a younger Jason anything, what would it be?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. Don't come back to Widnes. Second time. It's the worst career mistake I ever made. I came back because Widnes was the team that I supported as a kid, and it was that like the season was made more on sympathy by the heart rather than by the head. And the other thing I would tell Jason is sign your contract when you agreed the contract at Castford. Sign the contract at Castford. That's what the one thing that would that's the only thing. I don't have that many regrets, but saying that I say that, but I wouldn't have then gone into rugby and I wouldn't have met the people that I've met. I wouldn't have got. Probably wouldn't have had the career that I have away from it, to be fair, because all that came from on the back of contacts within, believe it or not, within rugby union and so forth and so forth. So,
Word of mouth was mega strong back then though, mate.
yeah,
Wasn't
absolutely.
it? So like your word was as good as a signature, wasn't it? You can't really do that now.
No, I absolutely no. I think without sounding too political, I think with our current government, to be fair, it's completely in the last 14 years, it's changed the ethos of our country for a lot worse. I'm a little bit old school in that respect, where your word is your bond.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I've been bitten quite a few times by doing that, to be quite honest, which is quite sad actually, but it's just the way the world is nowadays.
It's not down to you though, is it? That's down to them, mate. It's
It's
not your fault that that matters.
Society, the way that society's evolved over the last 14 years. It's quite sad, actually.
Yeah, no, it is, mate. Right. So if you're out and you're with this reunion that we spoke about and
Oh.
you've had a few beers, mate, the microphone ends up in your hand, Jace. What are you gonna give us on the karaoke, mate?
Oh, that's a brilliant, brilliant question. I love that one. Oh, what would I sing? Back to life, soul to soul.
Yeah.
Back to life, back to reality. That's Martin. What's what that was? If anybody's fans remember Martin Afire's black BMW that used to drive around in during the 90s, to be fair, that used to be blazing out of that, but during the 90s as well. If there's any, speak to Dowdy about that one, to be fair. That's the one of Martin Back to the Soul to Soul, the song's booming out the blue, his big black BMW.
So was it a one mark man, was yeah?
I believe it or not. I used to sort of, I was and I wasn't. Top of the town. I remember to go into the opening at the top of the town. It was never a landmark thing to be first. So we used to go to, I used to socialise in St. Helens because obviously I was from St. Helens.
Yeah.
So I used to sort of, a lot of my sort of socialise, but it was only when Toppers opened, to be fair, which is when obviously when Kurt and Jim and Sammy opened that I did that quite a few times. But no, a lot of the time I would stay in St. Helens, to be quite honest.
Okay, mate. Right, so that's the end of the daft questions. But if you're willing to, mate, and I appreciate I let you down a little bit because I didn't send you the questions and I thought I did. A 1 to 13 that you played with.
Oh, God. Well, six is easy because that's Tony Myler.
Yeah. What was it about Tony, mate? Because, like,
oh, mate.
Everyone just, like,
oh, mate,
adore him, don't they?
Yeah, Tony had everything. He was physically strong. He was physically quick. He could step off both feet. His brain worked like no other rugby player I've ever seen in my life. He could just, he just could do everything. He literally could do everything. It was scary. Okay. Are we talking a rugby league or a rugby union team here?
Either or, mate. Rugby league, God, if you can, because that's where you spent most of your career. But
Alan Tate at fullback, Martin Afire on the right wing. On the left wing. Darren Wright. Andy Curry, Jonathan Davis on the wing. Halfbacks. No, I'll put Dave Eumann. Dave Eumann instead of Andy Gregg. I'm not an Andy Gregory fan.
And Eumann at seven.
Yeah. Dave Eumann at seven. Front row, I'll go with Kurt. I'm going to throw a curveball in at nine, which is a kid called Jason Ramshaw, played hooker with me at Keighley. I'm going to put David Young in at 10. Oh, this is so hard because people like Yeston Harris and people like that, not even in the team. Oh, Kieran Cunningham as well. I can't even one pick Kieran Cunningham.
I was going to say, yeah, he played at Wales with you, didn't he?
Yeah, I would pick Kieran Cunningham. No, I'm going to put Kieran Cunningham at nine. Sorry, scrub that one. Kieran at nine.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in the second rows. I'm going to go with Mark Geyer.
Yeah.
And I'm going to throw a couple of, so then in the second row, I'm going to put, oh, that's just so hard. I'm going to put Marty Wood in there, playing with it, Keighley, because he was unbelievable. Not even pick Nick Pinkney or anybody like that. I can't believe that. Looking for somebody at 13. No, I'll put Marty Wood in at 13. I'm looking at somebody in the second row. Mark, to play with Mark Geyer to give me some balance. I'm going to put Morsi Coloto in there. What a back row that would be. Two monsters and a ball playing these forwards.
Imagine you'd want to play in courts in that team, mate, wouldn't you?
I'd love to put up, mate, I'd love to sit. Can I sit on the bench in that team?
Oh, she can.
Well, that would be coaching that team would be for ladder.
You've been listening to Trot the Egging. Thanks to our sponsors Bardell Sports. Follow us on Twitter @TrotTheEgging and Instagram @Trot_the_egg_in.